school schedules and work schedules are competing for time and space in the home right now.
I'm working from home now. I have 3 children. I cannot work with them.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear how books and stories are helping to keep the peace. We'll also hear about the rise of contact tracers, learn how labs are rearranging their priorities, and spend an academic minute with some timely nursing. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The Santa Rosa County School District in Northwest Florida has launched a new educational program called One District, One Book. As part of the initiative, every elementary student will be reading from the book A Boy Called Bat. Students will have grade-level assignments stemming from the story that will serve as their entire curriculum for the remainder of the school year. Sandra Averhart reports.
One District, One Book. It's all in one. We've got the book. We've got the schedule for parents. We have assignments broken down by week.
April Martin is director of elementary schools for Santa Rosa County. She says the One District, One Book assignments also are broken down by subject to include reading or English language arts, math, science, and social studies.
The activities and assignments included in the work packet are all aligned to the Florida standards by grade level. So the work that's been created is individualized. For example, kindergarten students, their work meets kindergarten standards and is on their level. And the same thing goes for first grade, second, third, fourth, and fifth.
According to Martin, district officials decided to pursue a new approach to at-home learning after receiving a lot of feedback from families struggling with the initial distance learning configuration.
One dad in particular, I'm working from home now. I have 3 children. I cannot work with them. They can't be online all at the same time. And so this helps us having these work packets instead. We had a mom say, I am a healthcare worker. I work in the ER. I'm working around the clock, 12-hour shifts. I can't be home to monitor my child online or work one-on-one with them. And we realize there are so many different needs among our families.
To help identify more balanced and equitable educational opportunities for students and families to learn at home, the district turned to its Director of Federal Programs, Dr. Karen Barber. She says they found the One District, One Book program through the family literacy organization Read to Them and ordered some 13,000 copies.
So with our federal funds, we were able to purchase for every student in our school district A Boy Called Bat, written by Alana K. Arnold. And it is a wonderful, wonderful book about an elementary age boy who works with his mother, who's a veterinarian, to raise a baby skunk kit.
Barber says the book has wonderful themes and lessons related to friendship, social skills, responsibilities, and more that have been transformed into enriching extension activities for literacy, math, and science for families to do together at home. It also builds on the momentum of the district's STEAM Innovate initiative.
To make this even more special and to connect it to our community, we have a variety of guest readers, and we are going on location to where they are in the community, learning about the organization that they are with, and they're all animal-related organizations. We're finding out about other wildlife in the community, careers that have to do with animals and wildlife, and we're actually taking a virtual field trip with our students and our guest readers.
Welcome to the Science Station!
for this first guest reader video, an enthusiastic greeting from the Navarre Beach Marine Science Station.
Our station is located on Navarre Beach in our classroom.
Wearing
by
a
the
big
sea,
red squid hat with large cartoonish eyes, Director Charlene Morrow explains that their coastal classroom teaches dual enrollment marine biology and oceanography to Santa Rosa High School students, who in turn teach younger students who visit on a regular basis.
Today I'm joined by Casey Fearon.
Hi, I'm Casey Fearon. I teach 8th grade science at Gulf Breeze Middle School.
And Katie Whitmire.
Hi, I'm Katie. I'm a former student of the Navarre Beach Marine Science Station, and I volunteer out here. And this is Nurdle, our African sulcata tortoise.
We are super excited to read the first
Before the reading begins, we learn more about 3-year-old Nurdle and the little plastic pellets that he's named after. Then it's on to Chapter 1, After School.
Bixby Alexander Tam stared in the refrigerator trying to decide what to eat. He knew that the longer he took, the more energy he was wasting, and Bixby Alexander Tam did not like to waste energy. But also, he didn't like to eat leftovers or cheese that had to be sliced, or any of the yogurt flavors in the fridge. "Bat, close the refrigerator door!" yelled his sister Janie from the kitchen table.
Hey everyone, my name is Michelle and I'm the wildlife rehabilitator here at the Emerald Coast Wildlife Refuge. And today we have one of our animal ambassadors, Riley, and she is a striped skunk. So the things about skunks is that they
Before
are mammals.
Before commencing with chapters 3, 4, and 5, Michelle Pettis tells us more about Riley's story and shares general information about skunks.
They're also warm-blooded, so they are similar to you and I. They are born alive.
Very appropriate for the story of a found skunk in A Boy Called Bat.
Chapter 3, No Vanilla Yogurt. Mom was supposed to be home by 5 o'clock, but 5 o'clock came and Mom did not arrive. By 5:15, Bat wanted to call.
To complete the first week of One District, One Book, the owners of a bee apiary will serve as guest readers for Chapters 6 and 7. A full video schedule and grade-appropriate learning packets are available on the district's website. The packets for each level begin with questions to ask before, during, and after reading the book. There's information about skunks and multidisciplinary activities and worksheets that families can work on together. And regardless of each student's age, the district is asking that families read the book out loud together. Again, Dr. Karen Barber.
If there was one takeaway, what we're really trying to achieve here is not just to collect grades or to provide work for kids at home. Our goal is to create a culture of literacy in every home in Santa Rosa County.
Even though there is a web component to the One District, One Book program and the videos enhance the experience, access to the internet is not required to read the book and complete the coursework.
That report from Sandra Everhart in Santa Rosa County, Florida. So speaking of storybooks, like many Americans, you may be working from home. When the COVID-19 crisis began, businesses around the country had to adjust, and suddenly living rooms and bedrooms became Zoom conference rooms, and parents were juggling jobs with roles as full-time caregivers. The American Heart Association took a moment to consider how this new world would look for their employees and how the organization could make their life a little easier. That same week, Joe Williams, an American Heart Association Health Information Project Manager, was looking forward to reading to his daughter's grade school class. The coincidence led to the AHA's Storytime Project, a way for employees and their kids to take a break and connect in a difficult time. Williams spoke with Mary Darcy about the lessons of Storytime.
What was it of all the things that you could have chosen to do for the families that were at home that made you think, story time, this is the thing that I should do?
I think, you know, in times like this, you need something that's comforting. From a very early age, at least in my existence and then my kids' existence, like the wind down, the relaxing, the safe time is, you know, story time right before bed. In situations like this, you think, you know, what would make people feel at most at ease is sitting around listening to a story. You know, the one we did today, I had my 3-year-old on my lap and she's just entranced listening to the other people read. And it's just, it kind of takes everything else down.
And there was support right away?
You know, right away. It was immediately like, this is a great idea. Let's do it. You know, and we did it. And they've been very supportive during this time. It's been fantastic. You know, or one email went out when this first happened, that, and it was from one of our executives, that, you know, we realize that this is going to be difficult. And we understand that you're going to be on a video call and a child may run behind you with a cape on and a Cheeto up their nose, and that's okay. And that was in the email. And having that kind of support has been really helpful in this process, I think, for a lot of our staff, is having executive management say, look, we get it. You know, we understand, but we're also doing stuff that, you know, makes it just a little better.
Describe what story time looks like for us and feels like.
It's, you know, a story around a fire, but the fire's a laptop. You know, in this case, it's very unstructured. We say hello to everybody. We say, okay, does anybody have anything they want to share? Does anybody have anything fun that they did yesterday? Those kinds of things. We're going to share our artwork. So some of the kids brought their artwork with them to share. The next one we have is going to be favorite sports. So, you know, your kids are going to share what their favorite sport is and what they like to do, whether they like to watch it or play it. You know, then we go into the story. And Too Many Carrots was the first book. That was a request from one of the kids from the previous one. It's about sharing. And I ended up doing a Llama Llama book too, which is, we're huge fans of the Llama Llama series. We've got tons of them. And I did Llama Llama Time to Share. And I picked them not realizing that they were in, like, both about sharing. So, you know, we talked about, like, you know, sharing, and they weigh in. You know, we get done with the story. We ask if anybody else wants to tell us anything. And sometimes the kids pipe up and say, like, I did this today, or I went for my bike. And we let them be part of it, you know, and, you know, sometimes the adults share too. And then we kind of sign off and we'll say, we'll see you next time.
What has surprised you about this experience?
What surprised me the most, I think, was, first of all, like, I was just throwing out kind of a silly idea. I didn't think anybody would like it. And then everybody's like, oh, that's a great idea. I was like, all right, well. And the amount of people were on the first one, I was like, oh my goodness, this is a lot. The biggest shock is how much better it made me feel during this time. It really helped me feel better. And that was never the intention. It was never the intention for this to help me, but it did. You know, I had a lot of anxiety about this, you know, about what was going on. And I got done with the first one. I was like, wow, it was 30 minutes where, like, I didn't, you know, worry or think about the worst possible outcome for this thing. So if anybody out there is having trouble, go read a kid a book and see if it helps.
Tell me what you have taken from this experience that you maybe want to bring into the post-COVID world.
Oh, I think one of the biggest things is, like, the understand, like, the power of kindness, like how important that is, how what such a seemingly small thing can make such a big difference in your own day or life or someone else's. Like, what we're going through right now will forever change how we go through life, but also forever change how we go through life in a positive aspect too. You know, I think I have a team that's all remote and I have calls with them a lot. And when you ask them, like, you know, how are you doing? You ask somebody, how are you doing? You know, in January, it was kind of a hollow thing. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, that's a general salutation. It's not really, you didn't really think about what's behind it. Like today, when you ask how someone's doing, like, it means a lot more. And I hope to carry that meaning of how's it going, you know, past this, you know. Really understand, like, that means a lot more than it used to. But I'd say just how important just being nice to someone is in a day. And just, and it only takes a second. It doesn't cost a thing.
Joe Williams is a health information project manager for the American Heart Association. He spoke with Mary Darcy about the organization's Storytime program. Still to come, we've been hearing a lot about something called contact tracing lately, and we're about to hear more next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A new group of professionals are joining the fight against the coronavirus pandemic. They're called contact tracers. And while the current pandemic may be the first time most people have heard about it, contact tracing is not a new thing.
We used to have people who did this job of contact tracing for different diseases, measles, polio, tuberculosis.
That's Dr. Timothy Hoff, a professor of management, healthcare systems, and health policy in the DeMore McKim School of Business and School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs, Northeastern University in Boston.
This was part of what your local public health professional did back in the day, and it's obviously coming around back into importance again.
Contact tracing is exactly what it sounds like. When someone tests positive for the coronavirus, investigators attempt to find anyone the patient in question had contact with. This not only helps officials track the pandemic, but also informs people that they may be in need of medical attention.
There's no doubt what they call shoe leather epidemiology, which is people finding out from people who have the disease who they've been in contact with, and then in the old days, going and knocking on the doors of those people to figure out who they've been in contact with and to let them know that they've been exposed to whatever illness is being part of this. So it's interesting that it's come back around again, and it's something that at least several states like California, Massachusetts, and New York are going to rely heavily on as they reopen their states.
Dr. Hoff says contact tracers were used extensively at the onset of the AIDS epidemic in the U.S. Since then, HIPAA and other privacy laws have made their job a bit more complicated.
It doesn't necessarily have to violate people's privacy, you know. So for instance, I think in Massachusetts, the way they have it set up is the contact tracer connects with a person who's been diagnosed with COVID, gets their immediate contacts who they've been in contact with, then they pass that information on to another contact tracer who doesn't get the name of the person who gave that information. And then that second contact tracer goes and connects and contacts the individuals that have been exposed. Now, that's not perfect, but it's sort of like a two-step process. So the people ultimately get contacted and indicated that they might have been exposed. They don't ever know who gave them their name, and the person who's contact tracing in that situation also doesn't know the person's name.
And although Hoff called contact tracing shoe leather epidemiology, the job is now mostly done at home with a phone and a good internet connection. He also believes that the job requires a certain skill set that can't be taught at a training session.
Do you need a college degree? No. Do you need a really good personality? Skills like empathy, listening, being able to ask good questions, being able to gain people's trust. Yes, I mean, those are all required elements, I think, of becoming a good contact tracer, because remember what these people are being paid to do. They've got to get information from people who've been diagnosed with the illness, and people might be reluctant to give that information. People might be embarrassed to give that information. People might feel it's an invasion of their privacy. So I think more of the skill sets really are things you don't necessarily learn in a school. They're things that are unique to someone's personality and someone's own makeup.
Dr. Timothy Hoff says that while bigger cities and coronavirus hotspots are currently trying to quickly build a roster of contact tracers, eventually those positions will be needed nationwide, especially if there is a second wave of the disease later this year.
I think until we find a vaccine, this is going to become a normal part of, you know, let's say in the United States, every state's repertoire. I mean, I was looking online and a lot of states are, and localities are sort of taking it into their own hands and ramping up. I was looking in one part, in one locality, I think in the Midwest, right now they were sort of having the sheriff's department do this. And they were having people who work for the sheriff's department actually doing contact tracing. I think every state and locality will have to have sort of a contact tracing workforce working on a regular basis. How many you need is a question, but certainly hot spots and big urban areas like New York, San Francisco, Boston, Washington, Philadelphia, Detroit, they're going to need hundreds probably of these types of people, at least right now. And if the disease comes back, the illness comes back in the fall, to do this sort of work. And they'll have to be sort of people that are on standby to kick in whenever there's an outbreak somewhere.
Dr. Timothy Hoff is a professor of management, healthcare systems, and health policy at the DeMore McKim School of Business and School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs at Northeastern University in Boston. During the COVID-19 pandemic, clinical laboratories have remained an essential part of hospital operations. Labs have faced the need to plan for potential surges of hospitalized patients and simultaneous shortages of laboratory staff. While hospitals may have disaster plans and policies, this pandemic presents unique challenges, and labs can learn from each other's experiences as they develop contingency plans of their own. An article in the Journal of Applied Laboratory Medicine summarizes recommended strategies for these plans in the clinical lab. It was written by Dr. Allison Chambliss, the Director of Clinical Chemistry and Point of Care Testing at the LAC-USC Medical Center in Los Angeles, and Dr. Nicole Tolan, Associate Medical Director of Clinical Chemistry and Medical Director of Point of Care Testing at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. They discuss their article on the podcast JOM Talk with host Randy Kay.
First question is for you, Dr. Tolan. When and how did your labs begin making contingency plans for changes in operations amidst the COVID-19 pandemic?
So we started these plans in early March, as soon as we got directives really from the state for the hospital to shift away from routine elective and non-emergent procedures. At that time, the hospital leadership was working closely with our intensivists to outline what the COVID preparations would look like and the testing strategies. And then following their guidance from the leadership, we began assessing how the surge preparations could really have a large impact on the clinical laboratories. Now, we recognize that the potential for COVID-19 surge may have really passed at this point, but we had put these plans in place pretty early on, and they can be reenacted if we see resurgent in the future or some other emergent disaster.
Great. Thank you. Now, over to you, Dr. Chambliss. Your article mentions planning for increases in testing volumes for some tests, but decreases in demand for other tests. Can you explain this contrast and provide examples of tests that may go into each category?
Sure. So Dr. Tolan mentioned that her hospital was shifting away from those routine elective and non-emergent procedures, as was ours. And routine preventative wellness check visits were also being deferred. So in the lab, we started seeing declining testing volumes in things like vitamin D and TSH. And we also saw declines in orders for serum and urine protein electrophoresis. So we would occasionally close the electrophoresis bench for the day if the volume didn't warrant running a batch. And so these are the types of tests where results are not needed rapidly to support inpatient care. And so they could perhaps be deferred or delayed if needed, especially if there's a shortage of laboratory staff. Now, on the other hand, tests we know that we had to maintain and prioritize to support inpatient care, particularly rising numbers of COVID patients, included tests like blood gas panels, complete blood counts and electrolytes, inflammatory markers like CRP. In these types of tests, we did not see declines in test volumes, so we made sure to keep those bench areas fully staffed. And so now that more information is coming out regarding treatment protocols for COVID patients, this can be helpful in addition to consulting with hospital leadership to determine which types of tests will need to be prioritized.
All right, thank you. Now, labs, they might have concerns for staffing shortages with potential exposure and required quarantines. So what strategies have you come up with to maintain the laboratory workforce? We'll start with you, Dr. Tolan.
Sure. As I mentioned earlier, really following the state DPH and local government directives regarding social distancing, along with our own departmental instructions for working remotely when able, we outlined a plan to organize the laboratory workforce into two groups, alternating weekly basis, who was on site and who was working remotely. And this allowed us to prepare for staff exposures and mandatory quarantines that were thought to come. This essentially created a pool of laboratory staff who were working remotely, practicing social distancing, of course, but were able to be called in when we had on-site staff call out. And this was particularly essential on the off shifts where staffing were already running at a limited capacity.
Yeah, so we also thought about how we could recruit more hands to help out in the lab if the staff numbers decline. So this included, we actually cross-trained anatomic pathology lab staff who were not as busy in their testing areas due to those cancellations of elective procedures. And we also trained pathology residents to work as lab assistants and to collect nasopharyngeal swabs for COVID RNA testing. So So as a bonus, this actually proved to be a great educational experience for the pathology residents in a time where their conventional style learning was on a bit of a hiatus.
Dr. Allison Chambliss is Director of Clinical Chemistry and Point of Care Testing at the LAC-USC Medical Center in Los Angeles. Dr. Nicole Tolan is Associate Medical Director of Clinical Chemistry and Medical Director of Point of Care Testing at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. They spoke with Randy Kay on the podcast JOLM Talk. Does breast milk help babies tell time? Really, that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How does breast milk affect a baby's sleep schedule? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Darby Saxby, associate professor of psychology at the University of Southern California, Dornsife, explains how getting the right milk at the right time can help babies get more sleep.
Struggling with getting your newborn to sleep at night? Your breast milk could be a factor. The composition of breast milk changes throughout the day. Milk produced in the morning has higher levels of cortisol, which helps the body mobilize for action, while melatonin, a sleep and digestion hormone, is much more prevalent in night milk. With a growing number of mothers pumping their milk, it's likely some babies are receiving morning milk in the evening and night milk in the morning. Although this question has not yet been formally studied, it's possible that the consumption of mistimed milk could alter the internal clocks of infants, impacting sleep, digestion, and development. One solution might be for mothers and milk banks to time-stamp pumped milk, so babies can drink from a bottle that was pumped at the same time of day as they're feeding. Neonatal intensive care units are already taking steps to help set the internal clocks of infants, such as dimming the lights at night. Now we need research to test whether time-matching milk could help newborns in NICUs regulate their circadian clocks better. Of course, a simpler alternative to organizing pumped milk would be to support a mother's ability to breastfeed her children by providing more comprehensive parental leave. In addition to the benefit that milk consumed straight from the breast provides to a baby's circadian biology, studies show the physical touch and bonding time may offer other benefits. If time-matched milk does turn out to be a key way to help set babies' internal clocks, the public health case grows stronger for policies that support mothers' ability to breastfeed their babies right on time.
That was Darby Saxby of the University of Southern California, Dornsife. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.